Bandwidth for November has been provided by CacheFly, the fastest, most reliable CDN in the business. CacheFly delivers all of our content here at 5x5, and they're the best. Check them out at cachefly.com, CacheFly, and let them know that you heard about them here on 5x5.
I'm recording.
Okay, I'm recording.
I'm recording too.
Here we go. 3, 2, 1. We recorded this episode on November 10th, 2015. This is On The Grid, episode 141. This week, I reveal an invention I've been working on, and Andy tells us that he's part of the problem. Here we go.
My microphone is held together with rubber bands and hair ties currently.
Oh, that's how you're supposed to do it. That is podcast etiquette 101.
Well, I mean, they make these rubber things that are specifically for holding the shock mount in place. They came with the shock mount. And, you know, it's only been like 2.5 years I've had this mic and this mount, and they just like rotted through. They dry rotted and just fell apart.
Yeah. They also stretch out terribly too.
It's almost as if this podcast shock mount was not made to last. It's not, I wouldn't call it a quarter century shock mount.
Oh, it's not some sort of high quality material, long lasting iPhone charger?
You know what's wrong with today's material culture, Matt?
Tell me.
Everything.
Things just aren't made to last.
That is the problem. Well, Andy, you're going to love this.
Okay.
You know, I was going to say they're a sponsor, but they're not paying for this because this is my thing. I'm making a jacket, Andy.
You're making a jacket.
I'm making a jacket.
But Matt, there are so many jackets in the world. Ah. Why another jacket?
But this is made of the finest materials, the highest quality materials.
What sorts of high quality materials are we talking about here? Some sort of space age fabric?
Not only is it space age, it's American fabric.
You're actually going with the bit that it is space age fabric, because it's the thing is they all say like high quality materials, and then it's like canvas, and it's like, yo, canvas has been around for a long time. Nothing against canvas, but don't act like it's an innovation that your jacket is made of canvas.
Not only is it space material, it's also canvas.
It's canvas space material.
Yeah, it's canvas that you can use in space. If you go into space, it will still exist.
Mm-hmm. And am I correct in assuming this jacket comes with some sort of promise of lasting forever?
It will last for 1,000 years.
1,000 years. 1,000-year jacket.
1,000 years. And if you come back to me in 990 years and prove to me that it didn't last, I will give you another jacket.
Another jacket.
One more jacket.
Now, can you also promise it will be in style for 1,000 years?
Yeah, because it's designed to be timeless.
I don't think it's just funny to anybody else.
You know what people like who are walking through the woods? Timeless jackets.
Mm, yeah, because you know the woods are also timeless, except for the fact that we cut them down to make jackets.
In fact, it's so timeless that it comes with an iPhone 6S lightning bolt charger.
The latest iPhone.
The absolute latest iPhone.
Surely the latest and last iPhone. I heard.
The cable is stitched right into the jacket so that you can never get it out, because it will never need to change, mm-hmm. because it's timeless and the latest.
And is there also a flap on the back where I can store my phablet?
You can store your phablet, your netbook, your laptop, your iMac, your desktop, your PC gaming computer, your Alienware, your iPhone, your iPad, your Surface 2, your iPad Pro, and other things.
I'm impressed at how many devices you were just able to list off the cuff. You know that
store them in your cuff.
Okay, he's still
iPhone
going.
Pockets in your cuff.
You know the guy that plays Buster on Arrested Development?
Yes,
actually
I do. Tony Hale.
Yeah, he's a devout Christian. And you may recall the one scene in Arrested Development where Buster kind of flies off the handle and is swearing at his mother and calling mm-hmm. her names, and it's all bleeped out.
Yep.
Apparently, Tony Hale did not know enough curse words to say in that amount of time, so he had to call his friends to get them to tell him some curse words so he could say something during that time because he's so devout.
I will also tell you, I don't have that problem.
Yeah, no, I'm good at coming up with swears.
I can come up with as many curse words yeah. as you need.
Also, you can just say a thing and put a little sync on it, and it sounds like a swear word.
Yeah.
Like, you fucking blimpy.
Yeah, you can say almost... Actually, here's a cheat. Say any ethnicity in a mean way, and all of a sudden it's a racial slur. So you can use that to come up with infinite number of curse words.
Like a Canadian.
Ugh. In fact, my jacket is American, not Canadian.
Is this your actual jacket now? So you know the here's another cultural reference. You know the business card guy with the YouTube video about how his business card is die cut, his business card is foil stamped. You know that guy?
Yes, yeah. I do.
Yeah. So one day I got it into my head that I should see what else this guy has put out into the world other than this business card video. And it's much sadder if you look at the rest of his videos, but equally on brand for him. And one of the videos is him, in fact, going through his custom jacket that he has had designed and manufactured for him. And one of the features is an enormous pocket on the inside that holds his old school laptop. It might have been an old video, but like the laptop is like, you know, 2 inches thick or something. And he's like, puts it in this big, ugly jacket that he has. And he's like, look, can't even tell I got a laptop in my jacket. And he pulls out and goes, bam, laptop.
Wow.
It's like a 20-minute video. And it's like him in a hotel room going through how he travels and what he puts in his jacket. And it's like, it's really special.
Is this the very first everyday carry?
I don't think it's the first, but he's definitely at the intersection of the everyday carry demographic and also the douchebag demographic.
Mm-hmm.
He sits right on that cusp, that hot intersection of those verticals.
Based on the first time you explained everyday carry to me, I would have thought that is already a thing. Douchebag combined with everyday carry person.
Oh, yeah. I mean, those things do exist. I'm just saying he's hitting those demos, you know?
Oh, okay. So the two circles come together right where he lives.
He's really working the verticals.
And that is his target market. That is where he sells all of his custom jackets.
It's amazing how many of these things sound like sexual innuendos when you talk about really working a vertical market penetration. I'm just coming out of the middling beard phase. Like, you know, when you decide, I've decided as of last year that I'm going to just grow a beard every winter and then shave it off every spring and summer.
Okay.
And then just, I don't have to decide if I'm a beard person. I think I said this on the show before, word for word. But
yeah,
that's what I'm doing. So I'm doing my winter beard again. And I'm just coming out of the sort of middling beard phase where it looks like you just forgot to shave for too long. And you look like a gross person. And now it starts to look like a choice, which is good. So I'm coming out of that phase, and I'm feeling better about my appearance.
See, this is you put yourself in the situation. I've just decided I'm never going to shave all the way ever again. So I don't have to worry about that. You've just decided to put yourself halfway in and halfway out at all times.
No. Maybe you misheard me. I'm not going to constantly trim my beard to middling beard length. I'm going fully shaved or fully bearded the whole year round, except for this 4-week period in between.
No. What I'm saying is, obviously, during the winter months, you have to grow it out, so you're going through middling beard, and then during summer months, you slowly shave it back down to not a beard, so you're constantly in flux. I understand. Look, I'm very clear on what you're doing. You don't have to explain it to me.
I have a very accurate laser hair trimmer, and every day I cut my hair by twice the amount that it grew.
You go in reverse just a little tiny bit and get it right back down to normal.
Uh-huh. And then if you look at a graph of my beard over time, that shit is a smooth curve.
Kind of in and out, in and out, in and out. Very smooth. I understand. Don't be so condescending. I don't understand why you have to explain everything to me.
Why does Dan sound so exasperated?
Because we are exasperating human beings.
He clearly made a choice for us to hear that sigh, because he could have just gone off mic. He could have...
That was a decision he made.
You sighed so loud, Dan.
He was 10 feet away. And that's how loud it was.
You sighed so loud that the neighbors just called me and asked how you're doing, because they're concerned about you.
We're concerned that our neighbor is exasperated. Come help.
We're concerned that our neighbor is a old steam heating system. Just...
You know, old steam heater Dan.
Old steamy hour. For you people at home, get out your decoder rings and find out what this week's secret message is. Can we do that? Can we?
Oh, secret decoder rings?
Wait. This is a big deal. This is a big deal. So you know, like the scene from A Christmas Story with the Ovaltine and the decoder thing, and then he just tells him to buy more Ovaltine.
Yeah.
We could do that, but with real messages for our listeners, and we could basically have like a Patreon or something, and if people gave enough money a month, we would send them the decoder, and it wouldn't be a ring, I don't think, unless we really wanted to get nostalgic. We'd probably make like a computer file or something that would they could type something into, and it would decode it based on some proprietary encryption we put into there.
Is that how we could do our ads now? Just have them decrypt something and it says like,
decrypt an offer code. Yeah. Decrypt an offer code.
Oh, do you think we could get Ovaltine to sponsor us if we did that?
Yes.
I would love to have
Sponsored
Ovaltine as a sponsor.
By Ovaltine. Here's the problem, though. If we let Dan be in charge of any of this, obviously the secret message is always going to be fart. I'm a little bit worried about that.
I'm going to give Dan a little more credit than that. I think he'll come up with a very sophisticated dirty joke to make the message every week.
Yeah, I'll switch it up with butts every once in a while.
He just keeps switching it up by saying butts over and over again. He thinks that's switching it up.
Yeah. It's all different synonyms for butts. It's butts in different languages. It's a very multicultural butt joke. But maybe this is better than a newsletter. You know, I'm getting tired of doing a newsletter. It's so much work every week, so many words. Yep. The message could only be
God
like
forbid
a short
Andy
sentence.
Has to do a newsletter every week. Some people have to edit hours of nonsense audio, but Andy has to write two paragraphs.
Look, nobody's comparing anything, Matt, okay? Don't make this about you. I'm just saying that maybe if you're really focused on writing a really good sentence every week instead of a somewhat mediocre newsletter.
Instead of one of us just opening the flood of our mouth and spewing audio for 17 hours and then Matt having to turn it down to a tight one.
Ugh.
Now our audience thinks you talk for 17 hours per episode, but I edited it down. See? See what I just did? Andy's mouth is a fire hose of noise.
Anyway, I kind of, you know, I've been thinking about... I'm giving a presentation on Thursday.
Sure.
Today is Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working on this presentation passively for... better part of 6 or 7 months. And when I say I passively been working on it, I mean that what I did is I started a new channel in my private Slack, of which I'm the only team member.
Mm-hmm.
And the channel was dedicated to things related to this talk. And I just put stuff there whenever it popped up and seemed relevant or whenever I had a thought that I wanted to sort of put into there. And now I'm doing all the hard work of going through and trying to make any sense of this huge mess of random thoughts that I've had over the past 7 months. But the gist of the talk, and this will come out after I have given it, so I'll report back next week on whether or not it was any good.
Okay.
But the gist of the talk is just kind of an observation about how I think the language of graphic design, like, so we have, like, you know, the practice of graphic design, right? We have graphic design theory where people, you know, get all wishy-washy and talk about how the history of graphic design goes all the way back to people like making hand axes and arrowheads and, you know, designing things to solve their problems and cave paintings.
Oh, yes, design is everything.
Design is everything, exactly.
Sure.
There's that, which I think is kind of like design theory.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's kind of like design practice, which is like the practical side of design. And I think that there is a culture of design practice and also... like a set of values and aesthetics that kind of overreach across huge portions of that world. Like, I think there are a set of values that designers tend to think are not just taste, but rather somehow truth or correct. We touched on this a little bit in the past couple weeks. This has been kind of, you know, obviously weaving its way in and out of what we've been talking about each week because I've been thinking about it sort of separately. But I think it's interesting to me that design right now has kind of become a language that I think more than most designers accept and realize is really just a symbol of wealth and power and privilege. Like you think like back to the Middle Ages, right? Like to like feudal Europe or whatever.
Yes.
And back then, symbols of power and wealth were, you know, rare objects, rare materials, gold, gems, all that kind of stuff, because you couldn't get those things unless you were not just wealthy, but in a position of power, because that required connections to people that were traveling the world and connections to trade companies and, you know, rare inks and dyes. The reason that purple is the color that we sort of associate with royalty from that era is because of the sort of rare dyes that were sort of collected to make purple clothes that were that color. So all the kind of symbols of power in that era were of a certain kind of language. And now I think that the symbol of wealth and power has become sort of a design-like minimalism. I think this is partially due to the fact that design has kind of accepted this as almost its objective truth. Like, we look at Dieter Rams's list of what makes a good design, and we think about modernism, and we think about, like, I think very few designers would tell you that there is merit in unsimplifying something, in complicating it. Like, the idea of simplicity is so embedded in what we think design is that that kind of idea is very prevalent. And I think that now what companies and products and individuals do to sort of indicate wealth and power is speak this language of simplicity and this language that I think is very much the same as the language of graphic design.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you think that's a bunch of bullshit. Because if you do, I've got some changes to make to my talk.
No, I don't think it's a bunch of bullshit, but I do. I think it goes further, actually. I think it goes even further than just it's. I don't think it's just a furthering of Dieter-Rams, because there's been that, and then there's been the counterpoint to that, and it kind of keeps going back and forth forever, right? But one thing about right now, to your point about the purple dye being the most expensive dye that is a symbol of wealth, I've thought about this a lot too in printing, and like, well, the thing that looks the most expensive is the thing that costs the most, and so that's obviously why it looks expensive, because it is expensive. That's, you know, how we make an association. So
and
when
it's
things
kind of
don't
a
cost
chicken
any
and egg
money
situation
anymore, because, yes, it is. But yeah. So let's get to the digital age. Let's get to when things don't cost any money anymore. Pixels are free. Pixels are an even playing ground. One pixel costs the same amount in black and blue and whatever we want. So we go through the phases of we're going to decorate it the most. We're going to that might be a symbol of wealth for a period of time. But I think we're at the point where we've been through a lot of that, and now that everything is free, you can't just pay more money to have a more expensive-looking thing, so we have to decide on a kind of language of wealth, and that's what we've done. And simplicity, because we have this kind of legacy of modernism, and that ended up being tied to business, and that ended up meaning wealth or luxury, or like, you know what it is? It's tied to confidence. It's like the Tiffany logo, where it's like, what is the Tiffany logo? Well, it's a very tiny thing on a color. We're so confident, we'll just say Tiffany in a small way. We'll put it on this color that we own, and that's luxury branding. That's confidence. There you go. We're kind of just doing the same thing on the web, and we've adopted a language of wealth because we can't just spend more money on material. Material doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, so I think there's something to that, and I think kind of what you're getting at. Has the Tiffany's logo been that way for ever?
No. Actually, Pentagram did it a while ago, but they picked the color, they set it at the right size.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty recent, 80s maybe, in the 80s?
Yeah, because I think I remember them having like kind of a, actually what is now in some places very hip, kind of like stacked letter word mark that would have mm-hmm. like an ampersand and a T and a C and an O over top of it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a weird memory of that, though I can't find a quick example of it anywhere online. But I think it's like, yes, you're right, Matt. It goes deeper than this for those reasons. I also think it goes deeper because I don't think it's just incidental. Like, I think design has become such a symbol of wealth just because we had to make something the symbol of wealth, and so we chose this particular aesthetic because of arbitrary reasons. I think it's kind of comes down to the fact that, you know, designers make a big to-do about how design is valuable, right? Like, there's a lot of designers that spend a lot of time making a case for their own value, monetary and otherwise. And I think that that comes from kind of a place of lacking self-confidence. That comes from a place of insecurity, the sort of constant assurance of one's sort of value. And value ultimately means money, right? We're not talking about value in terms of, you know, cultural contribution. I think very few people I see in the design world are talking about how important their design work is to, you know, culture. I see people talking about how important their design work is to a business and how much money it can make them and how much money it can save them, how it can change the way they're perceived. And those are the ways in which people defend and sort of talk about design. And I think that we've been talking that way for a very long time. And I think that works, right? I think that we have essentially talked, you know, the corporate world into the value that design has, which is not to say that we, like, you know, pulled the wool over their eyes. It's not to say that it's not valuable, but I think that that has been the goal, it seems like. And I think this is all kind of a reaction to the fact that design has to differentiate itself. Design practitioners differentiate themselves from artists in this sense. You know, I think a lot of people that are designers will look at artists kind of like we said last week and say, oh, that's frivolous, that's, you know, not meaningful, it's not valuable. Mine is meaningful and valuable, the work that I do, because look at here how it affects your bottom line, affects this, affects that. And really, I think we owe a huge portion of what our industry is to the advertising world, which is only, you know, incidentally attached to design. It's like the advertising world was what had the huge boon during the communication age, and that's where all the money came from, and they happened to kind of incidentally involve us. It wasn't like the other way around. And so I think that, you know, all of this asserting our own value and all of this in, you know, coming from the corporate world and working for clients with lots of money, and you know, the companies that pay the most being able to attract the you know, most experienced designers and people going to design school and paying gobs of money for a design degree and then graduating and having to work for companies that can pay them. And all these sort of things, I think, have basically embedded it in our culture that design is very tied to money and to financial power. You know, Matt, if you are learning something and you don't seek out other teachers, you are just totally at the mercy of whatever the person teaching you decides to teach you.
So you're saying we need to seek some sort of outside expertise in order to get out of our own little bubble?
I think if you want to get out of your own sort of bubble and you want to get out of sort of the default inherited cultural history of your industry, a good way to do that would be to seek some sort of outside expert opinion. But I'm not sure how you do that because experts are hard to find.
It's so weird you bring this up. I actually have a sheet right in front of me that says, this episode is brought to you by Lynda.com.
What's on Lynda.com, Matt?
This episode is brought to you by Lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit Lynda.com/OTG. That's LYNDA.com/OTG.
Get on there, watch some videos about whatever it is you want to get better at, and learn from somebody that maybe is in a whole different part of the globe from you. This is the promise of the internet, people. Learning from people across the planet.
Learning from people who are top experts, who are passionate about their teaching, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah, they're not just some schlub on with the YouTube account that uploaded some tutorial because they thought they knew what they were talking about.
These are the kind of people that can help you master Excel, learn negotiation tactics, build a website, or boost your Photoshop skills. You go to lynda.com and you feed your curious mind.
And seriously, your time is worth money, okay? Lynda.com, very affordable subscription, access to all the videos entirely. There's no sort of hidden fees or anything. Once you're in, you're in. And you're going to save all the time that you currently spend right now sorting through YouTube videos of people telling you to do the wrong thing. You can't do that on Lynda.com. They don't let you. If you upload a video on Lynda.com, that's the wrong thing. The Lynda.com admins take that shit down immediately.
But they still have thousands of courses to stream on demand, to learn at your own schedule. Courses are structured so you can watch them from start to finish or consume them in bite-sized pieces. Each course has a transcript that you can follow along or search for answers and skip to that point in the video. You can take notes and refer to them later. You can download tutorials and watch them on the go, including your iOS and Android device. And you can create and save playlists to share with your friends, colleagues, or teammates.
You can make a playlist that is titled Videos That Will Help Me Break the Shackles of the Cultural History of My Industry.
I really want you to find a course on that specifically.
Let me go ahead and check and see what we got in terms of shackle breaking of the cultural history of industry. Let's see. There is a whole course, many courses it seems actually, on cultural differences in terms of executive decision making.
Oh, well, there you go. Check out that. With your Lynda.com membership, you can get unlimited access to training on hundreds of topics, all for one flat rate. Whether you're looking to become an industry expert, you're passionate about a hobby, or you just want to learn something new, I want you to visit lynda.com/OTG and sign up for your free 10-day trial.
Lynda.com. Just be a better person with more skills. No, I was saying that I don't think the aesthetics of wealth and power are incidental. I think that the rules that we have associated ourselves with as designers, the things that we've kind of latched onto as our guiding principles, you know, en masse. And yeah, there is some variation. There's a little bit of kind of fluctuation over time, but there is still, I think, a fixed thing you can say kind of represents some sense of, you know, values across different practices of design. Mm-hmm. These things we've attached ourselves to have inherently become attached to wealth because of how much money has been involved in the history of our industry. Like, I don't think it's incidental. I think that our values came from working in the advertising world, you know, in the middle of the century, and from honestly from sort of the virtues of reproduction. We talked a little bit about you know, kind of industrialization and how when things became reproducible, design changed, or even I would say like came into being.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of our sort of ideas of simplicity and our ideas of you know, clear communication and sort of clarity of an idea and sort of summarizing and simplifying and taking things away and sort of getting to the essence of something, I think a lot of that comes from the nature of reproduction of something. And I think that's how those things became associated with wealth, is because we made such a big deal about it, and there's so much of our history that's embedded in the history of money and power in America. But, you know, we talk a little bit about the problem with diversity in design. And I don't think the problem is actually, like, from what I've seen, I think there are a more diverse set of people that are practicing design as designers, maybe even that are going to design school, than are represented in conference talks, in awards, in the prestigious jobs, and sort of the people that are being the principals of different studios. Like, I feel like there is more diversity downstream than we're seeing represented kind of at the top of the stack, which I think points to a diversity problem in terms of our values, in terms of what we're celebrating, not in terms of like fundamentally what the design profession is. But, you know, I think that is a real issue and something we've talked about on the show, and it's something I think is kind of unavoidable if you look at some numbers and start to actually like listen to some people that are talking about these issues.
Yeah.
And given that, I don't think our sort of problem in our industry comes from like an inherited, you know, racism, because we're kind of a young industry relative to some other industries. You know, I don't think, like, I would say the fact that presidents have been historically white men is something you can say is like an inherited history of some real problems. And certainly graphic design is not separate from that history. We're affected by it as well. But I think there is something in the values of what design is that inherently attaches itself to like white male culture. I think the culture of simplifying things down and the culture of kind of reducing, which is really just a culture of averaging, right? Like when we talk about reducing something down to its essence, you're kind of cutting out all the things that make it complex and different, and you're kind of just averaging it out to something that is right in the middle of the road. And I think the culture of doing that is linked to a culture of sort of assuming that our culture is one that is sort of the norm and everything else is on the fringe, or assuming that sort of, you know, white popular culture is like the one culture and everything else is, you know, sort of a marginal thing. I guess what I'm saying is when the practitioners of your industry that end up in the history books are all European and American white men, and that is predominantly what are in the history books for graphic design. You look back on the major movements and blah, 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 and that's where everyone sort of ascribes huge value. When that is your history, and when your whole profession is designed around, A, catering to the companies, people, and organizations that are in positions of power and therefore can afford to hire you, because we are, frankly, a luxury. If there is a company that is, you know, we can talk about our value all day, but ultimately, you know, it costs a lot of money to hire a good graphic design firm. And ultimately, does your logo really matter that much? Probably only if you're already competing at some extremely high level with other large, successful companies. So ultimately, I think we have to accept that our services are a luxury. So
yeah,
we have this history of whiteness that sort of founded the field. We have this history of working almost exclusively across the board for organizations that are powerful, wealthy. And this is not by sort of ethical choice necessarily, but like, you know, it's by the way the system is set up, right? Like,
yeah,
you go to design school, you pay a lot of money in most cases, you get a design degree, then you go and work as a sort of low-level designer at some studio, and you slowly work your way up, and you've got loans. Most people can't afford to go do work for some nonprofit or go do work for a company that can't really afford it. You have to go work for the design studios that have enough money to pay you, and they only have enough money to pay you because they're working for clients that have enough money to pay them. And so like this whole system kind of propagates itself, and design is a luxury thing. I mean, I think it's really interesting to even see that, like, you know, the AIGA and the AIGA equivalent in Canada and probably in other countries as well, they both have, you know, a very sort of forward statement about spec work and how they don't approve of it. Like you cannot do your job for no money, is basically what they're saying, which again, I think comes from insecurity, but also comes from this idea that like design is really tied to money and to power. So we have this history, we have this clientele that we work with. And we have this kind of aesthetic that has sprung from it, which is this aesthetic of sort of simplification, right? Like we present an enormous company, an enormous organization, an enormous brand as a little mark, because that's sort of the little story we want to tell. You know, we take a complex product and we simplify it down to something that can be understood in 3 seconds in an advertisement. We're constantly kind of taking the world and breaking it down into these little bite-sized chunks. And I think being able to, the idea that you can look at the world that way and you can just sort of choose and pick what little pieces you care about and want to highlight, that only works if you are in a position of privilege, I think. I think people that where the world is not such a friendly place for them, they don't have the luxury of thinking in that way on sort of a low level, which is all to say that I think somehow all these things kind of tie together. And I think that the language of our industry, like what graphic design looks like aesthetically, what it feels like, kind of reeks a little bit of whiteness and of privilege and of this whole complicated history. And I think, honestly, this is part of what, this is part of our problem with celebrating people that are not white men at sort of the highest corridors of power in the design world. I think part of the problem is this history. I think part of the problem is all these things we've talked about. And I think part of the problem is that what graphic design is fundamentally on the books is white and male to some degree. So the fact that white males are the best at it as far as our values are concerned is not a huge surprise because our values are all fucked up.
I don't think you're wrong at all. I wonder that myself if, you know, the aesthetics that we're tied to are just the things that the people before us did over and over again, and we're just trying to echo those things. And obviously the people that became before us were the people in power, and the people in power were white males,
basically.
Yeah, because
it's not just what the people that came before us did, it's what history remembers of what the people that came before us did.
Right, exactly.
So it's whatever someone felt was due to write down and was worth recording, and, you know, there is a huge bias in that alone.
Even if, and I mean, even the symbols that kind of rose through grassroots are not recorded the same way. You know, if it didn't come out of a business or a firm or something that has a great story, it's just not. I mean, honestly, I've read those history books, those graphic design history books, and they don't really feature people who don't run the business of graphic design, who are doing it for other reasons. Maybe easily stated, but like better reasons, more for public good or something. They don't get mentioned.
Yeah. And when we talk about the distinction between like graphic design theory and practice and the graphic design like industry, like the industry has been, you know, up until, like, you think about the whole First Things First, the original First Things First, you know, the fact that that was necessary, I think, points to like the general way the industry was at that point in history, right?
Right. It was purely advertising. It was nothing but advertising.
The fact that they had people to sit down and write that and feel like that was the thing that needed to be said, I think speaks to exactly just how indoctrinated everything was in terms of the industry. So if you're making a history book of the industry, of course you're talking about these giant companies that paid lots of money to, you know, pay Paul Rand or Saul Bass to make a little mark with a circle and a line, and everyone was like, oh, it's the future. And it was. I don't mean to minimize that at all. But I don't think there's enough reckoning with sort of the cultural implications of the history of our industry.
But here's the part that gets me is it's not just that this is where we've arrived at and what we've decided is good design, is luxury branding, like whatever thing comes out of the legacy. But we've also, you know, these are also the people that influenced all of culture. These are also the people that did the advertising, that didn't just reach us, the kids who decided to go to art school and get a degree in this. These are the people that reached everyone. And that's what they see. That's what everyone sees. So we're not just repeating the language for ourselves to make us feel good.
Yeah.
I think we are trying to repeat a thing that is proven to work and do it over and over again for everyone else who's seeing it. So it's not just that. It's not just rebuilding, like, let's say we want to take this on. Let's say we want to change something about this. It's not just rebuilding our own visual language. It's then getting the world to accept it as well. Because whether you're of privilege or not, these are the images that have been thrown at you your whole life.
Yeah, yeah.
And
no, I agree. So that's part of what I haven't figured out how I'm ending my talk yet. Because ultimately, I want to talk about this idea, but really only in the sense of, like, here's a thing I've observed that I don't think people are talking about or thinking about, but not in terms of, like, here's an action item, or here's what we should do, or here's what's next, because it's such a deep-seated thing that it's not like anything's going to change, right? But I think some more awareness of it would at least be, or more conversation about it. Like, it may be that someone out there that's much more versed on the history of design than I am can point and poke holes in this all day. But I don't see these conversations happening. And I think the thing that's interesting to me is that, you know, this is, like you said, Matt, like, this is true not just of us. It's true of everybody that participates in the sort of visual culture.
Right. It's anyone who owns a TV or a computer.
Yeah. Yeah. And in this exact same story is true of not just design, but of other things as well, with slight shades of difference. But, you know, you could definitely say that the culture of politics is a culture of whiteness and maleness, I'm certain. Mm-hmm. I don't know much about politics, but I would assume that, given that it's been primarily championed by white males for the past 300 years in this country, that I think there's a lot of things about it fundamentally that are probably white and male. So you could probably say it about politics. You could probably say it about many, many, many other industries that I just don't know how to say it. So what's special, I think, about design is that this is one of the only industries I'm aware of where part of the job description seems to be a level of empathy with other people. Like, you can be a doctor and you can fix someone's kidneys or, you know, take out their appendix, and it does not matter what their cultural background is. You do not have to understand things the way they understand them. You just have to do the job you're supposed to do. You can come in and fix someone's plumbing in their house without understanding their cultural background. There's very few jobs. I think other ones you could possibly say come into play here. I think, like, teaching is one of them. Mm-hmm. And maybe actually to some degree, like, representational democracy, like representing a group of people in politics, in a Congress or in something. But jobs that
involve empathy to some, well...
Well, I mean, every job, I think, involves some degree of empathy, but, like, it's part of the rule of graphic design, right? Like, what you do as a graphic designer, you sit down and you say, okay, I am a user coming to this website, or I am a person visiting this museum, and I see this sign, and you're supposed to think, okay, not just what sign will make it clear to me, the designer, how to get around this place. You're supposed to be able to think, what sign will make it clear to most people that will get around this space? You know, what icon can I use that's going to make sense to sort of widest swath of the community that's not just going to make sense to my own particular sort of cultural viewpoint? Like, yeah. I think that part of the job is a degree of empathy and of cultural understanding, more so than in almost any other job. Like, I almost think that, you know, we, especially at big websites and stuff, you know, the Twitters and the Googles and the Facebooks of the world, where diversity is an even bigger problem because it's a nexus of design's diversity problem and of technology's diversity problem. I'm a huge advocate for more people from more backgrounds being in the room with those places, because I think, frankly, the tools would be something that would be safer for more people to use if there are more perspectives involved in designing them, right? Like, I think if Twitter had more people working on their design team, maybe they would take harassment more seriously or something. But I also kind of feel like our job as designers is to make it so while there should be women in that room, there shouldn't have to be women in that room for us to be able to design a tool that is safe for everyone to use and doesn't sort of present a huge abuse problem to a certain chunk of the population.
Oh, man. So, I mean, I kind of think that too, but that's a scary statement, right?
Well, so I'm not advocating for not keeping these spaces sort of homogenous and white and male.
But it's simply saying that your ideal of a good designer is someone who can empathize with all people, whether they are of that group or not.
Well, so my ideal of a designer is somebody that doesn't know everything about everyone's perspective, because I think that would be impossible, but is somebody who at least knows to check, right? like knows that it's their job to know and find out when they don't know.
That's also assuming that they know all the unknowns. Like, just because somebody can empathize and try as hard as they can to understand other people's walks of life and all of their experiences and factor that into their work, like, it's still not going to cover even a good percentage of it. I mean, if somebody else has a completely different experience, like cultural background and everything, that designer has no guarantee that they're going to know all the factors without at some point having that other person's experience to some degree. And they're just not going to get that through user interviews or anything like that. So,
there's a spectrum, though, and I think there's limits. Like, you're right, Dan. Like, I don't think any one person sitting in a room alone, given a pad of paper, can just sit there and think about all the things that they need to sort of account for. That's an unreasonable expectation to put on anybody. But you also can't sit down and talk to every single person that's ever going to use your product and figure out what all of their concerns, all of their specific needs are, because that's just completely impractical. So to a certain degree, design, I think, is fundamentally taking a broad swath of people and generalizing them, right? Like basically averaging something a little bit so you can at least say, okay, you know, there's going to be a bell curve here. And at what point on this bell curve are we comfortable saying that people below a certain point are okay to drop off? And that, I think, is the part that I think makes design unique in this one particular aspect, and why I think our diversity problem and our problem with our culture being so linked to privilege and power is one of particular import, because we, I think, are supposed to do that job. I think. I don't really know, right? Like, it's kind of new for design to have that kind of power, or at least have that kind of power in the places like Facebook and like Twitter and like Google and, you know, places where there's a lot of sway to these kind of decisions. But if we're not doing that in those rooms, like, who is, right?
Other people who are making whatever it is. I mean, that's assuming that other professionals don't care or aren't thinking to care.
I mean, I don't think it's in the job description of, a software developer or of an advertising manager or something to know these things, right? Like, their job is like, this software needs to do X. It's oversimplification, of course, but, you know, their job is kind of the technical aspect of making that happen. And if they're a really good software developer, their job is to ask why and figure out why it's supposed to make that thing happen and maybe do it in a different way that wasn't even predicted by the person that gave them that specification. But I don't know that you can say, like, okay, you as a software developer, go make this sign-in page or this page where people sign up for an account for our service, and it's your job to figure out, exactly what combinations of first name, last name, country fields we're going to ask for to sort of cover the most people. Like, I think that should be what design is. I don't think we should just be picking colors and shapes. I think we should be understanding how the users are going to interface with the product.
I don't agree, because that's designers saying we want to take that job because we feel like we're the most capable on the team. The difference is that software engineers can do it too. They're going to do it differently. And that's also, like, I'm a very firm believer that designers often don't do this sort of stuff right. Like, we fumble our way into it and we try to test and we try to, like, do as much research as we can, but we still fumble a lot. And I think that if that was up to software engineers or to a product manager or whomever else was going to take that responsibility, they would fumble as well. They would just do it differently.
So what do you see as design's responsibility in these situations then?
Well, I mean, the responsibility that we've granted upon ourselves as professionals is to do that, but it's us constantly trying to make the case that we are the most capable, and at least somebody's dedicated to thinking about that, where I think if we disappeared tomorrow, I don't necessarily think that everything is going to fall apart.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that you could say that design's only role at a sort of company like this is to pick the colors for all the buttons and pick the fonts. I think that would be actually closer to what we've done historically in our industry to what is actually our sort of charge. But I think that there's been an expanding of design's role, and I do think that you can't have every job be everybody's responsibility at a big website. Like, ultimately, I'm not advocating for anybody not being at the table. I'm not advocating for anybody being considered right over somebody else, but I feel like our job is kind of supposed to be to understand what the people that are using the website are going to feel, think, do, and sort of figure out how to communicate what they need to know or do to them as efficiently as possible. And when you're thinking at that scale, that involves a lot of empathy and understanding for other humans and their sort of perspectives and contexts.
So it's actually, I've been struggling with this myself recently, and I'm just curious what you think. I tend to agree with you. I want that to be my role. But why? Like, so our role historically is more just like, we're the people to make the visual things happen. We're brought into the advertising firm so we can, you know, pick shapes and colors or whatever. Why does that role fall onto us? Why did we either decide to take it on? Why is it empirically our role? Why are we deciding to take it on in the future? What makes that a designer's role and not anyone else's or a third person?
The what the specifically like the visual stuff?
Like no, anything that isn't the visual stuff. And the specifically what you said, let's see what countries are going to be in this drop down field or whatever. Why do you seem pretty confident about that? And I like doing that stuff. I don't know that that's traditionally a design role, but
it's not traditionally.
I like that
certainly.
It could be.
I like it as much as I'm cynical and critical of people that talk about how design's changing the world and blah, blah, blah. Like ultimately I do have high aspirations for what a approach to the world that sort of at a low level design theory, not graphic design theory, because I think graphic design is when you put the word graphic before design, I think these problems get magnified and sort of the depth of the culture gets shrunken down amazingly. So I think about design theory, which, you know, I think includes architecture. I think it includes urban planning. I think it includes product design, sort of making physical things. That sort of history, which is one of taking what's possible and figuring out how to put it best to use, right? Mm-hmm. Like we invent new methods of building tall buildings. We invent new methods of paving roads. We invent new methods of using plastics to make things. Taking that technology of what's available and all the people that are in those respective industries that are figuring out how to make those things available, make them work, and put them best to use is what I hope that a certain type of thinker is best suited for. And I think that role involves a lot of empathy with people that are going to be using the thing that you are designing, whether it's a website, whether it's the lobby to a big building, whether it's a city street or whatever. And yeah, I don't know. And I think the specific reason why graphic designers are getting into this on the web, Matt, is because on the web, the line between how something looks and how it works is basically non-existent. If something looks like a button, people are going to try and click it like a button. There is no other sort of aspect, right? Like you couldn't paint a building on a perfectly flat wall and have people try and use the front door to get in. They would be able to tell that it was just a painting.
Well, certain coyotes might, but I understand what you're saying.
Exactly. But on the web and on screens, like there is really no line. It's an extremely blurry line, like of what's technically possible and what you see. Our only interface is what we're seeing with our eyeballs. And really nothing else. Sometimes there's some sound, I guess. So what you're seeing is a huge factor on how the thing actually works and what it actually does. So naturally, the skills that we have, and you could, I think, safely extrapolate some set of high-level skills in terms of manipulating space, understanding composition, understanding color, understanding typography, across all of graphic design. Those skills are all of a sudden more powerful than they were before. Before, mm-hmm. we could make a great book layout, and, you know, that was something to be said for sure, and there's nothing, I don't mean to minimize that or make it sound easy, but, you know, making a good book layout is something with kind of a specific goal, and all books more or less work the same way. You turn the pages from beginning to end, and now, on the web, all we have is this canvas of screen, which extends to infinity in all directions, and all we have to sort of direct anybody to anything sensible is this sort of same language of shapes and colors and typography. So I think that is the reason why we have gotten aspirational collectively over the past 10 years or whatever, because I think we've seen that our skills are now being put to different uses, and to want to get better at that is natural.
Yeah. I don't know that our aspirations are tied to that, but I think our, in terms of the, we can save the world thing, but in terms of, we can take on more roles. I think that is,
yeah.
I think you're correct about that.
Collectively, I don't think we're trying to save the world, but collectively, I think we're trying to change the world in some way. Like, I think designers like to have an impact. I feel like that's another one of the things that people oftentimes look at art and say, art doesn't do this and design does, and it's have an impact. And again, what people mean mostly there is somehow financially. We had the impact on somebody's bottom line, we had impact on something that has to do with money, because that's what people matter. That's what people count in this country.
Do you have some sort of conclusion to your talk planned?
No, that's what I'm trying to figure out. I was hoping this talk would give me something. I don't know. Like, I think
the interesting thing is what comes next, because I think most of the points are generally right. I think our current culture is very much related to everything that came before it. I mean, as is any culture. And I think it will. Well, actually, here's the one interesting thing that you didn't bring up at all, is that the tools we use are very much being used by every other person in the world now, more and more and more and more. And I don't think that's going to stop happening. I don't think people are going to stop. Well, not just like simple stuff like everybody can get Photoshop. I don't even just mean that, but like the language we were using previously, as more and more people are using things like emoji and, you know, customizing their social media profiles or whatever, whatever the end of Helvetica used to be, whatever that MySpace, but just like that exponentially. As people start to use more and more tools of graphic design every day, because it's fun, because it's a new way to communicate. Maybe it's in some ways a better way to communicate when you only have text and you're trying to communicate emotion. Does that change everything? Because now everyone has the tools and everyone is influencing the culture and we don't really have a stranglehold on this anymore.
Well, so I think that's where the power comes into play. I think that people will have access to it and sort of the ability to sort of wield it in the way in which we could wield it.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're right. Like right now, anybody could go and make a menu for their restaurant and print it out.
Yeah.
And have a totally functional menu that was no better or worse than any other menu. It's got the prices, it's got the things, it all makes sense. They could probably even use a template in Microsoft Publisher or whatever, so it has like headings and some hierarchy. Anyone can do that. What those people can't do yet, and you could argue maybe eventually it'll be as easy to do this as it is for us now, is sort of, you know, design that sort of perfect menu. And what the perfect menu is a menu that drips of wealth, that just looks expensive, right? It's mm-hmm. it's letterpressed on a single piece of stock. It's extra thick and it's got lots of negative space and there's no dollars or sort of decimal points in the prices. It's just numbers next to words like infused ramen roe poached avocado. That menu, you look at it and it feels expensive and it also looks like something that Massimo Vignelli would design, right? Because
it looks
like it's done in a GD1 course.
But why isn't that happening in just emulating the style of corporate branding that happens all the time, that happens constantly? Because that, I think your thing you just said is dead and gone. The idea, because what you just said involves materials. So I'm saying forget about materials. The thing that just is dripping in wealth. Now we're just talking purely about the style of wealth. I would say that's being emulated constantly. That's what a Squarespace is trying to do all the time. So
yeah, you're right.
How far away are we? Not that far. Not that far from just emulating wealth. So once wealth is emulated, it's distributed to everybody. There will be, I mean, there definitely has to be a tipping point of like, that doesn't mean anything anymore. When everyone has a Squarespace and everyone has a nice website, the idea of a nice website goes away, right? I think.
Yeah.
Like, if
probably.
Everyone is using the language of wealth to communicate, then we just raise the, like, I think we talk about it as an industry as just like raising the bar, which, you know, okay.
Everyone should just note that raising is subjective.
Right.
We're changing the bar.
It's just changing it. So everybody now uses the language of wealth to communicate their personal portfolio or a LinkedIn page or whatever. Then what happens? Like, do we need a new language that is harder to achieve? Like, is it, because that actually is an interesting case, because the language of simplicity is great in the Industrial Revolution. It's great in trying to send files to each other on a computer because they're easily replicated, even though the conditions might be different. Now, is it complexity? Because it's hard. It's hard to replicate. It's hard to get multiple machines to do the same thing. And it requires some sort of wealth to get that done. It requires some sort of skill in order to complicate it. Like, I think there has to be some follow-up to everybody being able to use the same tools and everybody being able to deliver the exact same product that used to mean wealth. And it doesn't mean that anymore. And maybe that's just democracy. Maybe that's just everybody gets their way. But I do think it means things change, which is interesting.
Tune in next week to On the Grid to find out what happens next after everyone has access to the culture of wealth.
So, my happy ending is a video game.
Fuck off.
I don't,
I told you I was going to break the rules because I can't stop thinking about anything else. I kept going.
I was
through
hoping you'd
over
be
over
breaking
over
the rules in terms breaking of like, the rules. No, you know, doing dude. Something we said we would never do. Or
yeah,
something
this.
Interesting and unexpected. No, we said we did too much of this, but that's fine.
Yeah,
ahead,
I know,
just do it
but
again.
I don't know what to do. I don't know what you do when I keep coming back to this over and over again in my brain, and I'm like, oh, well, I should just force myself to like a different thing. I don't know what to tell you, Andy. I've only really enjoyed a thing, like one thing this month.
My happy ending is Madden. I love being good at football. I win every game. Sign
it's me. Not Madden. So
prove us wrong, Matt. Prove us wrong.
So this is a video game called The Beginner's Guide. And this was actually posted to our subreddit maybe a month ago or so. And it's one of the few things I've actually... I'm dead serious when I say like it's one of the few things I've done this month where I actually like sit down and dedicate myself to just doing one thing and not like thinking about 10 million other things. So this is a follow-up by Davey Rendon, I hope that's how you pronounce it. He created the Stanley Parable, and the Stanley Parable is a very interesting game where you play through what seems like a pretty basic story, and then everything changes. It doesn't follow the basic narrative you would expect, and...
AKA any video game with a story.
Sure, anyway. It doesn't follow that. So that's a very interesting game. I did love that game, and the interesting thing is I might have enjoyed playing that game even more than this one. But I haven't thought about it 10 million times since then. So anyway, that game came out. He won 10 million awards for Game of the Year. And clearly, that bothered him to a degree. He wrote about it on his blog, about this idea of creating for other people, creating video games that get praise, and then trying to follow that up. And then he came out with this game, The Beginner's Guide. And it's the guise is that you are looking at someone else's computer, you're looking at all these unfinished games, and you're kind of slowly walking them through. And the narrator is a friend of this person, in quotes, who created all these games, and is kind of walking you through his relationship with this person. And you get to walk through them. There's no real narrative structure. There's no objective. Well, there is a narrative structure. There's no objective to the game. You're not going to complete any one of these things. You're kind of looking at these little portraits. And it's clearly an expression of how he's dealt with criticism, people looking at his art, people responding to it, having expectations of it, and then what the point of actually creating is. And I don't want to give too much away. I would definitely say start with the Stanley Parable, play that through. Understand that got a great amount of praise. There's an article from his blog I will post, and then go play The Beginner's Guide and just turn everything off, put your headphones in, plug in your computer, spend the, I don't even know, $8, $9 on this game, $9.99. Spend the $9.99 on this game, give it 2 hours, enjoy it, and then see if you don't think about it for the next month, anytime you make anything ever. The Beginner's Guide.
Guess I'll have to play it.
Sorry to ruin your life. I just can't stop thinking about this game. It's a very interesting look at what it means to create something, what it means to release it into the world, why you even do that.
So it's not interesting in and of itself. It's only interesting given the context of his previous and successful game and his response to it.
I kind of think so, yeah. It's a creator's response to a world praising him, which is very interesting. Like, I feel like you're supposed to just nod and say thank you, and this is so humbling. It's you rarely hear somebody talk about the downsides of doing a successful thing. In a way, it's kind of like that TIG documentary about following up this weird success that you didn't expect. I think the Stanley Parable is a weird success more in that it's like an indie game made by not that many people, and suddenly it's getting Game of the Year on magazines that would probably previously be giving it to like a GTA or something. So,
but is that weird anymore? I feel like that's the norm. Like, I feel like video games are crushing everything forever.
I don't think it was the norm when that happened. What year did that come out?
No, definitely not.
Yeah, 2012, 2010, something like that. 2011. Yeah, there we go. We're right in between. I don't think that was happening in 2011.
Well, it's still, I mean, predominantly a lot of the Game of the Year awards and like Indiecade and other awards still predominantly go towards AAA titles or something of similar caliber. So, yeah, I mean, it is very strange that a truly like indie game from an indie developer went and got so much praise. So I definitely don't think that this happening should be discounted at all.
So anyway, yeah, sorry to do a video game. Just it's stuck with me, and it's just so hard. It is so hard for me to recently just sit down and dedicate myself to something and not worry about 10 million other things. So I don't know, man. It's a great game, and it makes you think. I don't know. Sometimes I don't know what's better, a thing that you enjoy immensely at the time, or a thing that you're like skeptical about, you're working your way through it, but then you just think about it all the time afterwards.
I guess it depends on if you like playing video games or thinking more.
I don't know. I like the Stanley Parable playing it more, and then the Beginner's Guide, I just think about it all the time, and I was skeptical about going into it because I was like, it's a follow-up to a game. What? How good could this possibly be? I don't know. You tell me. Look at your fish.
This has been On the Grid, episode 141. This week, I want you to find us on iTunes and give us a review. Go to iTunes, search for On the Grid, click on ratings and reviews, say something nice, and give us 5 stars. Thanks to Dan for the interlude music, Glassboy for the ad music, Girlfriends for the theme music, and finally, thanks to you for listening. Until next week.
I'm going to Canada tomorrow, and it just occurred to me that it's a different country. Like, I knew it was a different country, but, like, it didn't occur to me to, like, notify my credit card companies, or, like, I didn't occur to me my cell phone might not work, or that my credit cards might not be accepted.
Did you consider to notify your passport? Did you get a passport and make sure that it's up to date?
I have a passport. It is not yet expired, although I am approaching the end of the life of my first passport, which means I have to get a second one. But really, is Canada different? Like, is it different?
Have you not been?
No, I've never been to Canada.
Slightly more polite?
Not really.
Wait, Matt, is the first place you went that you needed a passport Canada?
That's a good question.
Because
if it was, it
doesn't count. I'm calling bullshit on it.
I don't think... Wait, what does that even mean? I don't know what that means. I don't think it was.
Well, you were saying I was a late bloomer. I didn't travel until I was 17. I'm saying if you traveled before 17, but it was only to Canada, you don't get to hold that over my head.
No. Well, actually, when I was a little kid, I went to Australia once when I was like 10 or 11. So, no, I have a lot over you.
Yeah, you're right. You're much more cultured than I am.
Yeah, I held a koala bear. Eat that.
Eat a koala bear?
I don't think that's exactly what I meant.
Love how you put that.
No, they eat eucalyptus.
Eats shoots and leaves.
Eucalyptus.
Yep. Why'd you say it again?
Because it's like you didn't
It's like
understand.
A spelling bee?
Yeah. You know,
can
like...
Can I get it in a sentence, please? Yes. When I was 10, I went to Australia and held a koala bear while it ate eucalyptus.
You know, eucalyptus, like you kind of... Those stationary bikes that you ride? Eucalyptus.
Eucalyptus. U-C-Y-C-L-O-P-Z. Eucalyptus.
Perfect. Nailed it.